Thank you very much, Johnson.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Quite welcome. So I ended the last talk with that extraordinary chorus that ends Murder in the Cathedral, so let me begin with something rather different. This was an unpublished poem of Eliot that appeared in about 2007, 2008 in the London Times. I don't know where they found it. I don't know where they got it. It's called Cows. Of all the beasts that God allows in England's green and pleasant land, I most of all dislike the cows. Their ways I do not understand. It puzzles me why they should stare at me, who am so innocent. Their stupid gaze is hard to bear. It's positively truculent. I'm very inconspicuous, and scarlet ties I never wear. I'm not a London transport bus, and yet at me they always stare. You may reply to fear a cow is cowardice the rustic scorns, but still your reason must allow that I am weak and she has horns. But most I am afraid when walking with country dames in brogues and tweeds, who will persist in hearty talking and stopping to discuss the breeds. To country people, cows are mild and flee from any stick they throw. But I'm a timid, town-bred child, and all the cattle seem to know. But when in fields alone I stroll, oh, then in vain their horns are tossed, in vain their bloodshot eyes they roll. Of me they shall not make their boast beyond the hedge or five-barred gate. My sober wishes never stray. In vain their prongs may lie in wait. For I can always run away, or I can take sanctuary in friendly oak or apple tree. This was actually based on experience. Emily Hale was visiting. They were walking in the countryside, and a cow came after Eliot. So it was indeed produced from something that was quite genuine. Now there will be a tie-in here in a moment. Trust me. I mean it's a delightful little piece. But first, I apologize, but I have to get a little academic on you. Okay, so the Herr Professor will now lecture a bit, and it has to do with the mechanics of poetry. Let me read a couple of statements that Eliot made, and it was something that he was aware of and had carried with him for quite a while over all the years. Again, this comment comes from The Music of Poetry, wonderful essay. There is one law of nature more powerful than any of the varying currents or influences from abroad or from the past. The law that poetry must not stray too far from the ordinary, everyday language which we use and hear. Whether poetry is accentual or syllabic, rhymed or rhymeless, formal or free, it cannot afford to lose its contact with the changing language of common intercourse. He pursues the point. No poetry, of course, is ever exactly the same speech that the poet talks and hears, but it has to be in such a relation to the speech of his time that the listener or reader can say, that is how I should talk if I could talk poetry. This is why the best contemporary poetry can give us a feeling of excitement and a sense of fulfillment, different from any sentiment aroused by the even very much greater poetry of a past age. And one of his criticisms of what had happened to English poetry, which is why he had to go abroad to France to begin to try to break out of what had happened, is that English poetry stayed stuck in an old way of speaking that no longer had anything to do with the way people talked in common to one another, on an average day in an average place. Now, obviously, he's not going to duplicate that exactly. He couldn't do it. But having pondered that for a long while, he came upon a different problem, which was this. And it had afflicted him, and he'd hidden it very well. The very accents he was using to render his poems and create their effects were still trapped in the accentual syllabic poetry that had dominated English verse since the late 16th century. And he was using it. It was there. It was so ingrained in him. April is the cruelest month. April is the cruelest month. Tiger, tiger, burning bright. Okay? There it is. The rising and falling pattern. The iamb, the trochee. Okay? Very common. As late as 1930, when he's finally finding his own voice, the opening of Ash Wednesday, because I do not hope to turn again, is a line of iambic pentameter that Shakespeare could have written. The accents are the same. The language may be updated. There are no words there that anyone would find strange, but the rhythms in the poetry are old rhythms, because I do not hope to turn again. And they were so in his blood that he became convinced he had to break out of those rhythms. He had to get away from those rhythms somehow. Now, one reason I read the song of the knights as they went off to make a martyr of St. Thomas is precisely for that reason. These rhythms are music hall rhythms, as I said. These are different rhythms. I'll just do the first stanza again, okay? Where is Becket, traitor to the king? Where is Becket, the meddling priest? Come down, Daniel, to the lion's den. Come down, Daniel, for the mark of the beast. That's a whole new rhythm. It was very much his own. It shows up in this very serious play. But what he knew was he had to find a rhythm that would match the language of more common speech so it could be more accessible to the listener, to the reader, in terms of a poetry that they could be comfortable with. He wanted, if you will, his poetry to become more conversational and more accessible. And much of that came from his beginning to work on the stage, where he realized the ear of the audience has to hear what's being said, and one has to be careful what one says and the accents in which one says it. At about this same time, Murder in the Cathedral had appeared in 1935. There's no other major verse until he publishes another book in 1939. It was very well received, but it was taken by many people as being a little silly, for the children, not an important work, but how nice of Mr. Eliot to do this. And it's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. Many of you may know the Broadway musical, one of the greatest hits of the modern musical stage, based on this book. Dame Helen Gardner, God bless her, good lady with a heart who could feel and a poetic sense, is one of the few that caught on to what he was doing in it, but she didn't comment at length about it because, as she said, she couldn't stand cats. Dog lovers may leave the room now, because this is going to get very uncomfortable. Even if you have an allergy to the furry felines, you might want to run. Here's a comment she makes. The brilliant dexterity of the verse in Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats has hardly been recognized. Now, he began writing these poems as gifts to children. Gifts of his employer, Mr. Faber. He wrote some for the Faber children. He wrote others for the children of friends. They came out occasionally, and it was decided that he would occasionally, he would keep them, he would collect them, and then he decided to publish them all together as a book. And there are in here a number of things going on where it's very clear that Mr. Eliot is, through these cat poems, breaking free completely from the old verse rhythms that he was trapped in. I'm just going to read the opening of a few of these poems, and all I want you to listen to is the extraordinary differences in rhythm, okay? They are highly imaginative, but you have a poet who is shaking off those old strictures, those old rhythms, by coming up with new ones and putting them together in this way. The Old Gumby Cat. I have a Gumby Cat in mind. Her name is Jenny Anydots. Her coat is of the tabby kind, with tiger stripes and leopard spots. All day she sits upon the stair, or on the steps, or on the mat. She sits and sits and sits and sits, and that's what makes a Gumby Cat. But when the day's hustle and bustle is done, then the Gumby Cat's work is but hardly begun. And when all the family's in bed and asleep, she slips down the stairs to the basement to creep. She is deeply concerned with the ways of the mice. Their behavior's not good, and their manners not nice. So when she has got them lined up on the matting, she teaches them music, crocheting, and tatting. Okay. It's delightful stuff. But you hear, the rhythms are shifting. You're not quite, there's a rhythm there, but you can't quite find a pattern. What you're hearing are accents, but you don't know when or where they're coming in the line, okay? Growl Tiger's Last Stand. Growl Tiger was a bravo cat who traveled on a barge. In fact, he was the roughest cat that ever roamed at large. From Gravesend up to Oxford, he pursued his evil aims, rejoicing in his title of the Terror of the Thames. Okay? The Rum-Tum Tugger. The Rum-Tum Tugger is a curious cat. If you offer him pheasant, he would rather have grouse. If you put him in a house, he would much prefer a flat. If you put him in a flat, then he'd rather have a house. If you set him on a mouse, then he only wants a rat. If you set him on a rat, then he'd rather chase a mouse. Yes, the Rum-Tum Tugger is a curious cat, and there isn't any call for me to shout it, for he will do as he do, and there's no doing anything about it. You can understand why Andrew Lloyd Webber picked up these poems. I am not an Andrew Lloyd Webber fan, but I will say Cats is his best score because all he did was put a little musical accompaniment underneath the rhythms that Eliot had already created. Okay, there's nothing wrong with being a second-rate composer. But for a second-rate composer to find his natural level is very rare. They either shoot too high, meaning they end up too low, or they get too popular and then their ambitions take them into territory they shouldn't pursue. Andrew Lloyd Webber hit it right here because he provided little sing-song. He caught the rhythms. He backed them up. I'm just going to do a couple more because I love them. The Song of the Jellicles. Jellicle cats come out tonight. Jellicle cats, come one, come all. The Jellicle moon is shining bright. Jellicles come to the Jellicle ball. Jellicle cats are black and white. Jellicle cats are rather small. Jellicle cats are merry and bright and pleasant to hear when they caterwaul. Mungo Jerry and Rumpelteazer were a very notorious couple of cats, as knockabout clowns, quick-change comedians, tightrope walkers, and acrobats. They had an extensive reputation. They made their home in Victoria Grove. That was merely their center of operation, for they were incurably given to rove. Okay, everyone is different. Old Deuteronomy lived a long time. He's a cat who has lived many lives in succession. He was famous in proverb and famous in rhyme a long while before Queen Victoria's accession. Very nice. Skipping over some, I hate to do it. I mentioned this earlier. I did it deliberately because here it is. The student at Harvard that he knew named McCavity. McCavity the mystery cat. McCavity's a mystery cat. He's called the hidden paw. For he's the master criminal who can defy the law. He's the bafflement of Scotland Yard, the flying squad's despair. For when they reach the scene of crime, McCavity's not there. McCavity. There's no one like McCavity. He's broken every human law. He breaks the law of gravity. His powers of levitation would make a faker stare. And when you reach the scene of crime, McCavity's not there. You may seek him in the basement. You may look up in the air. But I tell you once and once again, McCavity's not there. This is a poet freeing himself. You can almost feel the joy as he's putting these things down. You can imagine him reciting them to the children before he gave them to him. It connects with his love of Edward Lear, his love of Lewis Carroll. But there is a very serious purpose underneath, because what I just read to you is where he discovered the rhythms that would be used in his greatest poem, in my opinion, Four Quartets. The rhythms are in there. This is my very favorite. I actually just memorized it because I'd always wanted to, and this gave me an excuse. Just give you a bit of this. I'll do the full thing later because I want to. This is Gus the theater cat, okay? Gus is the cat at the theater door. His name, as I ought to have told you before, is really asparagus. That's such a fuss to pronounce that we usually call him just Gus. Now listen. The length of the lines change. The numbers of syllables change. Gus is the cat at the theater door. His name, as I ought to have told you before, is really asparagus. But that's such a fuss to pronounce that we usually call him just Gus. It is a four-accent line with a changing number of syllables. And what keeps the poem moving and what your ear is hearing without knowing it is that steady four beats that are always there, but unpredictable in terms of when they will appear and how they will be used. I move to the very opening. I'll say more about this later. I'm just trying to prove what the extraordinary accomplishment. Well, let me put it this way. Here's what he did. He listened to human speech, and what he found was that when we speak, we usually speak in phrases or sentences with four accents. That four-beat line comes from what Mr. Eliot observed was human speech at the time in which he was living. So what it's an extraordinary accomplishment. I don't know anyone that picked up on it. Dame Helen Gardner caught it and understood it. And she's the one who first... Eliot himself was working with, as we said, the rhythms that he had discovered. But it was there. It's what he was using. I go to the first line of the first quartet, which is Burnt Norton. And when we get to it, this is what we get. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. Hear it? It's there. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction. There's a three-beat line. He will vary it. Remaining a perpetual possibility, another three-beat line. Only in a world of speculation, he's free to vary it, what might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. Okay, I'll go through that in a moment. But what you're hearing is a new English prosody in English poetry that Mr. Eliot found on his own. And it's a remarkable, remarkable accomplishment. One other thing from the Cat poems that I think links directly with the four quartets. Let me read this. This is a comment he made in 1928. Someday I want to write an essay about the point of view of an American who wasn't an American, because his America ended in 1829, and who wasn't a Yankee because he was born in the South and went to school in New England as a small boy with a nigger drawl, but who wasn't a Southerner in the South because his people were Northerners in a border state and looked down on all Southerners and Virginians, and who so was never anything anywhere, and who therefore felt himself to be more a Frenchman than an American, and more an Englishman than a Frenchman, and yet felt that the USA, up to 100 years ago, was a family extension. We're back to the question that I raised at the beginning of these talks. Who am I? Where do I come from? Where do I fit in? Having been baptized and having come to the point of conversion, he began to get a sense of self. And as I said in Ash Wednesday, he speaks of I, because he now knows who he is. And he also is beginning to realize it is possible to have multiple names and multiple personalities, especially if you're going to write for the stage, but having that kind of freedom to be who you are at a given moment, at a given time, is indeed a great freedom, and it doesn't change who you are. The comment was made at one point that Eliot himself, early on in his career, had complained that he had three different names. When he went to work in the bank, or when he went to work at Faber and Faber, he was called Tom. He was the guy that they worked with in the office. It was Tom. When his poetry was written and people were talking to T.S. Eliot, the poet, he was the master poet, which he didn't like. He didn't care for that kind of praise, but that's how they would address him. And when he was home, Vivian would refer to him in private as Wanky Panky. A variety of names that eventually continue through his life. Listen to this. This is the first of the cat poems, The Naming of Cats. The naming of cats is a difficult matter. It isn't just one of your holiday games. You may think at first I'm as mad as a hatter when I tell you a cat must have three different names. First of all, there's the name that the family use daily, such as Peter, Augustus, Alonzo, or James, such as Victor or Jonathan, George or Bill Bailey, all of them sensible, everyday names. Tom. There are fancier names if you think they sound sweeter, some for the gentlemen, some for the dames, such as Plato, Admetus, Electra, Demeter, but all of them sensible everyday names. But I tell you, a cat needs a name that's particular, a name that's peculiar and more dignified, else how could he keep up his tail perpendicular, or spread out his whiskers, or cherish his pride? Of names of this kind, I can give you a quorum, such as Monkestrap, Quaxo, or Cory Copat, such as Bombalorina, or else Jolly Lorum, names that never belong to more than one cat. But above and beyond, there's still one name left over, and that is the name that you never will guess, the name that no human research can discover, but the cat knows himself and will never confess. When you notice a cat in profound meditation, the reason I tell you is always the same. His mind is engaged in rapt contemplation of the thought, of the thought, of the thought of his name. His ineffable, effable, effin-ineffable, deep and inscrutable, singular name. Well, T.S. Eliot, discovering who he was, becoming an I, being able to write about himself, goes back into his past in order to discover precisely the present. And the four quartets, each of the quartets, centers around a place that was very important to him at some point in his life or the life of his family. I'm not going to tonight, at this late hour after a long day, go through all of this in detail, but I'm going to give you a scheme by which you can come to read the four quartets, and then tomorrow morning I will go into more detail about some of it, okay? Here's the schema. There are indeed four poems. The first one began with material that he had pulled out of Murder in the Cathedral. The director said, Tom, it's good work, it's okay, but it doesn't fit, it's slowing down the action, cut it. And he was very respectful of directors who knew the stage, and he would follow their suggestions. So, a passage was cut, but he still found it interesting, and he continued working on it. And as he worked on it, he began to realize that this little passage might have a life of its own. And it began to turn into the first quartet. Now, what does he mean by quartet? It's a musical form, four instruments, two violins, viola, and cello. And what you have is a conversation among voices of those four instruments. So that the emphasis I've been putting all along on voice is indeed something that is naturally resolved in the notion of a quartet. Musical form was very important to him. So what he does is present themes, counter themes, the development of the themes, resolution of the themes that pass throughout the entire, all four quartets. And I'm sorry, I'm losing my concentration here. Lost it. Give me a second to recover.
Themes,
Yep. And the themes move from instrument to instrument. They recur over all four poems, each of the four quartets. Each quartet is in five movements. Now, The Wasteland was in five parts, but each of the individual parts is different. So, let me take you through each of the quartets, the location, the memory, what is focused on in that quartet, and then a sense of the overall shape. Here we go. The first one is called Burnt Norton, and it came out in 1938. It is the memory, as was the cow poem, of a time when Emily Hale visited him in England. And they visited an old mansion in Gloucestershire called Burnt Norton. It was called Burnt Norton because it had burned down at one point and the destroyed house was still there, but the reason people visited is that the old lovely gardens were being maintained. So he went with Emily, they went to the gardens, and he had an experience in the garden that stuck with him for years afterward. And he remembers it, and he's exploring it now in this particular poem. So it is a personal experience from his own immediate past. Each of the four quartets focuses around one of the four elements. The first quartet is the quartet of air. And indeed, there are references and images throughout the poem to dust. The burning of the building, the mansion house that had stood there for years that suddenly was destroyed, and the dust is still floating around there, in the air, okay? He announces at the very beginning of the first poem what his theme is. Many claim these are religious poems. I claim it's a philosophical analysis by a man who had belief and is not ashamed of allowing his religious ideas to come into the poetry. But he's examining an idea, and the idea is announced in the very first word, and it is the mystery of time, which is a very puzzling thing to all of us, especially as we grow older. Just a quick analysis of the opening lines. First movement of the first quartet. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future. As we sit here now, May 2nd, 2015, you have a past that you remember. It's gone. It's not coming back. This present moment right now is a present moment, but it's going, oh, there it went. It's gone already. Now we have another present moment upon us that, oh, that just went into the past. But perhaps all that past and this current present moment, oh, is still somehow contained in the future, because that's what we're heading into, and we're carrying all of that with us as we go forward. You can't shake the time you've lived in. It's there. And time future contained in time past. When I was a little kid learning to walk, when I was 12, 14, 16 months old, my future was already, this old, bald, gray-headed guy was already there in one sense. In order to get from my toddling around and falling on my little baby bum to this point where I toddle around trying to remember where I am and where I'm going, is a movement in time, and there is a direct timeline from the one to the other. And he's saying perhaps that future was already contained back there. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. If there is no past, present, and future, if we're living now in something that's eternal, how can we ever make up for the bad times we had in the past? We need the movement forward in order to redeem in time, present, or future the mistakes we made in time past. And fortunately, living in time, time can redeem us. We have a chance. We have a chance, okay? These are the verse is simple. The ideas are complex. What might have been is an abstraction. I could have become a tap dancer. You know, if I'd had the talent, if I'd had the tap shoes, if I'd had the lessons, there's a possibility I could have been a tap dancer, but it didn't happen. What might have been is an abstraction. Sorry, that only exists in my mind. There's no such reality there. It didn't happen. Only in a world of speculation, I could have been Fred Astaire too. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. The life I did lead, the choices I made, and the speculation of what I might have wanted to do still lead to this point, the present, this particular moment. I can't escape either. The reality of what I did or the speculation of what might have been doesn't matter. I'm still here right now. And then this beautiful image. Footfalls echo in the memory down the passage which we did not take towards the door we never opened, into the rose garden. My words echo thus in your mind. Whew. Footfalls echo in the memory down the passage which we did not take. You can't free yourself from those memories of alternate choices. They're somehow there. We all speculate on them. Down the passage which we did not take, towards the door we never opened, into the rose garden. There was something else there that might have been a beautiful possibility. My words echo thus. But to what purpose disturbing the dust on a bowl of rose leaves? I do not know. Why bother with all this? Let the dust just lie there. Okay? I doubt if he knew this story, but whenever I read those lines, it comes to me. Oscar Wilde was touring America. He was a huge popular success, giving lectures. He was in Cincinnati and invited to luncheon at the home of a very wealthy lady in Cincinnati. And they had a lovely luncheon, and she's giving him a tour of her home, which is filled with beautiful things. And she comes upon, I think it was a Chinese vase, maybe a Ming vase. And she went up to it, and it was covered in dust. The servants had forgotten to dust the vase. She was horrified. She said, "Oh, Mr. Wilde, please forgive me. It's just scandalous, this beautiful vase. Look at it. It's just covered in dust." And this is Wilde. He came back immediately and said, "Madam, do not apologize. Dust is the bloom of time." So wonderful. "But to what purpose, disturbing the dust on a bowl of rose leaves, I do not know. Other echoes inhabit the garden, shall we follow?" And we're now opening that door that we didn't think was there. Suddenly it is there, into the rose garden. Anybody know where that comes from? Going down the hallway and suddenly coming to the door and opening the door, and there's this gorgeous flower garden. It's Alice in Wonderland. It's Alice in Wonderland. It's Lewis Carroll again, okay? But what it is that to open that door suddenly is to enter a kind of wonderland. "Other echoes inhabit the garden. Shall we follow?" "Quick," said the bird. Find them, round the corner. "Through the first gate, into our first world. Shall we follow the deception of the thrush?" Can we trust that little bird that's saying, "Come on in, find it, come on." "Into our first world, there they were." We don't know who they were. "There they were, dignified, invisible, moving without pressure over the dead leaves, in the autumn heat, through the vibrant air. And the bird called in response to the unheard music hidden in the shrubbery. And the unseen eye beam crossed, for the roses had the look of flowers that are looked at. There they were as our guests, accepted and accepting." It seems to be somehow previous generations, previous owners of the house. It's a ghost-like vision. It is those who lived in time past. "So we moved, and they, in a formal pattern, along the empty alley, into the box circle, to look down into the drained pool. It's autumn, the pool has been drained, it's empty. Dry the pool, dry concrete, brown-edged. And the pool was filled with water out of sunlight, and the lotus rose quietly, quietly. The surface glittered out of heart of light, and they were behind us, reflected in the pool." There's this moment of sudden vision, clarity, something beyond time. Suddenly in the autumn, this pool is filled, and behind us are all those mysterious figures. Who were they that are suddenly there with us, that are part of the scene, reflected on the water? Great beauty. Wow, we've had these moments. I understand. I get it all. I know what's happening. Then a cloud passed, and the pool was empty. It's just a moment of insight, connection to something higher, bigger, beyond, outside of time. "Go," said the bird, "for the leaves were full of children, hidden excitedly, containing laughter. The past, those old figures behind us, and now in the leaves up above, children, the future, laughing excitedly at the silliness of what? Our pretensions, our thinking we understand, that we're the most important thing, that moment was somehow eternal. No, time goes on. "Go, go, go," said the bird. "Humankind cannot bear very much reality. Time past and time future, what might have been and what has been, point to one end, which is always present." It's the end of part one. Okay? It's lovely. But please notice, what do we have here? Themes introduced. Themes introduced. Time, connected with moments of sudden deep understanding that seem somehow connected with eternity. The notion of ancestry, those behind us, the ideas of nature, okay? The idea of children and laughter that are somehow connected. The sense of what might have been that never took place. The sight of the notion of what has been. the moment of vision and insight, coming out of nowhere in an unusual place. The first movement of each of the quartets, an element, air, a place, this mansion, a season, it's autumn, okay? There is a vision, there is a memory, there is a sense of time and eternity that are both there somehow struggling, but it's a puzzle and it remains a problem. We can't quite sort it out. Now, I'm not going to go through. I'll just say generally, the second movement is in two parts. The first half is a lyric, a formal lyric poem that somehow uses very powerful images to convey in a different sense or in a counter sense what was in the first movement, okay? If you will, a contrary theme. And then there is a second half to the second part, which is a prosaic discussion in something, it's still poetry, but a very relaxed language that is discussing the ideas, but no longer in tense, controlled, well-ordered images, but rather in a more talkative sense. Just briefly, this is the lyric that begins part two of Burnt Norton. Garlic and sapphires in the mud clot the bedded axle tree. The trilling wire in the blood sings below inveterate scars, appeasing long-forgotten wars. It goes on. And then suddenly we get, at the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is, but neither arrest nor movement. And do not call it fixity, where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance. I can only say there we have been, but I cannot say where, and I cannot say how long, for that is to place it in time. It's talkative, okay? Still interesting ideas connecting with. Now, I read earlier part three. What happens in the third movement of each of the quartets? There's a descent. The problem has become so complicated that we're heading downward. And we're facing things, problems, ideas that face us because we cannot work out the puzzle of time, where we are, the world we live in, what we're presented with in the present moment. It's in there that you have the vision of the men going to work in the underground and the flashes on their faces, okay? Only a flicker over the strained, time-ridden faces, distracted from distraction by distraction, filled with fancies and empty of meaning. It's the modern world. It's this awful vision of the modern world. People trapped in time, and it's time without meaning, living lives without meaning, going through motions, just repetitive motions that seem to have more meaning. And then there's at least a hope of some sort of resolution. Part four, the fourth movement of each, is a gorgeous, every one of them, a gorgeous lyric poem that resolves all the tensions, but does so in a mysterious way. We're not given a solution, okay? 9 divided by 3 is 3. It's not like that. The solution is in the poetry, in the images, in what we're given with a remarkable kind of beauty. What I'm going to do tomorrow morning is go through, and it will be appropriate for a Sunday morning, the four fourth movements, okay? They become more remarkable as they go along. And the fourth movement of the fourth quartet is, by common consent, the greatest lyric poem written by anybody in the 20th century. It also has unbelievable application for the present time. So that's something you can look forward to for tomorrow. The final part of the fifth movement, he reverses it. We begin, it's a recapitulation, the themes come together, they're settled a bit, but we begin with the prosaic section, okay? The poet just talking in a more regular kind of voice. But what he talks about in almost all of them is the difficulty of writing poetry in the modern world. How do you say it? What do you say? How do you do it? How do you use words? What does it mean to wrestle with words? How do you use words when words themselves are dying? Where do you find the proper words to use without it's beginning of the fifth movement here. Words move, music moves only in time, but that which is only living can only die. Words, after speech, reach into the silence. Only by the form, the pattern, can words or music reach the stillness, as a Chinese jar still moves perpetually in its stillness. It's fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. And then the whole quartet ends with one last lyric section, highly imagistic, beautifully poetic. The detail of the pattern is movement, as in the figure of the 10 stairs. Desire itself is movement, not in itself desirable. Love is itself unmoving, only the cause and end of movement, timeless and undesiring, except in the aspect of time, caught in the form of limitation between unbeing and being. Sudden, in a shaft of sunlight, even while the dust moves, there rises the hidden laughter of children in the foliage, quick now, here, now, always. Ridiculous the waste sad time stretching before and after. And we end in the present moment, okay? Second quartet, East Coker. A little village in Somerset. And it is the village from which Eliot's ancestor, Andrew Eliot, left England in the 17th century. The Eliots left from there. Eliot goes back to the town, the little town, that the Eliot's family left England from. If you will, an Eliot returning to the place where the Eliot journey began. He goes there, and again he sees ghosts. And even as he reports what he sees the time when his ancestors left there. And of course it begins, in my beginning is my end. It began with the Eliots leaving. This is the end point of his journey to get to this particular village. In succession, houses rise and fall, crumble, are extended, are removed, destroyed, restored, or in their place is an open field or a factory or a bypass. The village that was there is now modern. It's been modernized. It looks nothing like what had been before, okay? I'm jumping ahead a bit. This is incredible. He sees an open field. In that open field, if you do not come too close, if you do not come too close on a summer midnight, this is the summer poem, okay? This is the earth poem. You can hear the music of the weak pipe and the little drum and see them dancing around the bonfire. The association of man and woman in dancing, signifying matrimony, a dignified and commodious sacrament, and suddenly the language becomes 16th century language and spelling. He's taken a section from a very famous book called The Book of the Governor, written in the 16th century by an ancestor of his, Sir Thomas Eliot. And all of a sudden, I don't know, his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather's voice comes out of him in 1940 as he writes the poem. It's again, time past is suddenly now exactly time present, but he's looking back at a time when in the little village they danced around the bonfire with the pipe and the drum to celebrate a wedding, commodious matrimony, okay? Two and two, necessary conjunction, holding each other by the hand or the arm, which betokeneth concord, round and round the fire, leaping through the flames or joined in circles, rustically solemn or in rustic laughter, lifting heavy feet in clumsy shoes, earth feet, loam feet, lifted in country mirth, mirth of those long since under earth nourishing the corn. And in the earth poem, he knows everything goes back to the earth. Everything ends up under the earth. But it's not useless. It's nourishing the corn that has kept sprouting there for century after century. It's extraordinary. Then we go through the same process, okay? Part two, a lyric, the prosaic part, a descent, okay? And this one is very stark because he's already introduced the subject. Oh, dark, dark, dark. They all go into the dark. The vacant, ill interstellar spaces, the vacant into the vacant, the captains, merchant bankers, eminent men of letters, he's including himself, the generous patrons of art, the statesmen and the rulers, distinguished civil servants, chairmen of many committees, industrial lords and petty contractors, all go into the dark. And dark the sun and moon, and the Almanach de Gotha, and the Stock Exchange Gazette, the Directory of Directors, and cold the sense and lost the motive of action, and we all go with them into the silent funeral, nobody's funeral, for there is no one to bury. Boy, everybody dying, everybody going into the earth, going into the earth. Works through it, puzzles through it. And then comes the lyric. Man, it's a knockout. I'll talk about it tomorrow. Recapitulation with another prosaic section, and then the lyric at the end. The third poem, The Dry Selvages, the water poem, Gloucester, Massachusetts, Cape St. Anne, where he went every summer as a child and saw the water and fell in love with the water and fell in love with sailing. And he begins with a magnificent depiction of beginning in St. Louis and then going to the East Coast, to Cape St. Anne. And what he remembers most directly, and I've mentioned it before, but here it comes now, is the Mississippi River that he went to as a little boy and saw rushing down through the land. I do not know much about gods, but I think that the river is a strong brown god, sullen, untamed, and intractable, patient to some degree, at first recognized as a frontier, useful, untrustworthy, as a conveyor of commerce, then only a problem confronting the builder of bridges. The problem once solved, the brown god is almost forgotten by the dwellers in cities, ever, however, implacable, keeping his seasons and rages, destroyer, reminder of what men choose to forget. Unhonored, unpropitiated by worshippers of the machine, but waiting, watching, and waiting. The river is within us. It's the flow of blood. The sea is all around us. And we go from Missouri to the seacoast, the Atlantic seacoast. The river is time, flowing constantly forward. The sea all around us is eternity. And once again, as a little boy, he experienced both. And then we get extraordinary images of the sea. The descriptions of the sea in The Dry Selvages are just wonderful. Still presenting a problem, especially in terms of the poor fishermen who make a living there and go into the sea not to return, which is resolved in the fourth part, the lyric, which is a prayer to Our Lady. At Cape St. Anne, there is a church, a chapel, Our Lady of Good Voyage, where the fishermen would go and pray before they set out. And out in front of the chapel is a statue of Our Lady who watches over the sea at all time. And the fourth part is a prayer to Our Lady watching the fishermen on the sea. Can't do it tonight, I'd lose it. And then the same pattern, of course, the final movement, a prosaic section, and a final beautiful, beautiful lyric. The last is Little Gidding. Oh, an extraordinary poem. It's a small, tiny village in Huntingdonshire. I don't even know where that is in England. I'm not sure. But there was a small Anglo-Catholic religious community that was set up there in the 17th century, where they came together to simply pray and be together and worship, that wound up being the place that King Charles I ran to and hid when they were seeking to find him and kill him at the time of the Revolution. Okay? And Eliot visits this little chapel one day and prays there, and that's the memory, and it's the fire poem, okay? The last one is the fire poem. And it's, again, a remarkable piece of work. I'll just read the lyric that opens the second movement, in which all the elements seem to be destroyed. He takes all of those elements from the earlier quartets and here just sets them aflame. Ash on an old man's sleeve is all the ash the burnt roses leave. Dust in the air suspended marks the place where a story ended. Dust in breathed was a house, the wall, the wainscot, and the mouse, the death of hope and despair. This is the death of air. There are flood and drought over the eyes and in the mouth, dead water and dead sand contending for the upper hand. The parched, eviscerate soil gapes at the vanity of toil, laughs without mirth. This is the death of earth. Water and fire succeed the town, the pasture, and the weed. Water and fire deride the sacrifice that we denied. Water and fire shall rot the marred foundations we forgot of sanctuary and choir. This is the death of water and fire. And then we head into the prosaic section where, as an air raid warden during World War II, walking the streets of London alone in the dark, he meets a ghost. And that's a nice place to end that I can talk about tomorrow. But before you get away, I'm doing this for myself because I want to. Gus the theater cat. I have to keep my script in hand because I'll probably fumble. The old memory isn't what it used to be, which is part of what the poem is about. Gus is the cat at the theater door. His name, as I ought to have told you before, is really Asparagus. That's such a fuss to pronounce that we usually call him just Gus. His coat's very shabby. He's thin as a rake. He suffers from palsy that makes his paw shake. Yet he was in his youth quite the smartest of cats, now no longer a terror to mice and to rats. For he isn't the cat that he was in his prime, though his name was well known, so he says, in its time. And whenever he joins his friends at their club, which takes place at the back of the neighboring pub, he loves to regale them, if someone else pays, with anecdotes drawn from his palmiest days. For he once was a star of the highest degree. He has acted with Irving. He's acted with Tree. And he likes to relate his success on the halls where the gallery once gave him 7 catcalls. But his grandest creation, as he loves to tell, was Fire Fror Fiddle, the Fiend of the Fell. I have played, so he says, every possible part, and I used to know 70 speeches by heart. I'd extemporize back chat, I knew how to gag, and I knew how to let the cat out of the bag. I knew how to act with my back and my tail. With an hour of rehearsal, I never could fail. I had a voice that could soften the hardest of hearts if I took the lead or in character parts. I have sat by the bedside of poor little Nell. When the curfew was rung, then I swung on the bell. In the pantomime season, I never fell flat. And I once understudied Dick Whittington's cat. But my grandest creation, as history will tell, was Fire for Fiddle, the Fiend of the Fell. Then if someone will give him a toothful of gin, he will tell how he once played a part in East Lynne. At a Shakespeare performance, he once walked on pat when some actor suggested the need for a cat. He once played a tiger, could do it again, which an Indian colonel chased down a drain. And he thinks that he still can, much better than most, produce blood-curdling noises to bring on the ghost. And he once crossed the stage on a telegraph wire to rescue a child when a house was on fire. And he says, "Now these kittens, they do not get trained as we did in the days when Victoria reigned. They never get drilled in a regular troop, and they think they are smart just to jump through a hoop." And he'll say as he scratches himself with his claws, "Well, the theater is certainly not what it was. These modern productions are all very well, but there's nothing to equal, from what I hear tell, that moment of mystery when I made history as Fire for Fiddle, the Fiend of the Fell."